Thank you all for joining us this morning. And in the hecticness of getting us started today, I'm not sure I even asked if anybody was new. And if you are, very big welcome. And to all the familiar, lovely faces, another welcome. So this is the first Sunday of March. March, a kind of a harbinger of spring. At least in my garden here in Lake Union, there's Daphne blooming and hellebores blooming. Some of those early spring trees, and we hope everybody's doing well. So we're, the whole year, we're studying the paramis, these beautiful qualities of the heart and mind. And March is the parami of sila, or morality, or virtue, ethical conduct. And before I get started, I would like everybody to just take a moment. Think about what are a couple of the words that come up as you start thinking about spending another month or much longer on morality, on sila. And if you're willing to put some of those words and phrases in the chat, just to be mindful of what are we bringing with us as we start talking about sila. So I'll give you a minute, and then we can share some of these in the chat before I get started on my... Bring them up and start clarifying, lightness, kindness, and integrity. Thank you. Ethics is focusing on what makes others and yourself happy. Thanks, Thomas. Nice and needed. Virtue leads to contentment. Sin and punishment. Yep, it's the full spectrum, isn't it? We'll give people safety. Nice. Wow. What a full, wonderful, I think this is supposed to be restraint from Charlotte. Charlotte, did I get that right? Yeah, I think so. Kindness versus being right. Oh, thank you. Wow. I don't need to give a talk. Everybody's got there. Everybody's already doing the work, huh? Kindness, again, versus being right. Well, lovely. Thanks, everyone, for participating in that. How much all of us have in common rather than what separates us. Oh, yeah. Okay, so as we talked about in the opening month of January about the paramis, and also during last month on generosity, the paramis are considered perfections. And perfecting is a process of exploring, gaining some understanding, making commitments based on the understanding, and embodying those commitments in our lives, in our daily lives. During a Sunday morning a few weeks back, we came to what felt to me anyway like a group understanding that once a parami really took hold in us, and it became natural and didn't feel like it was such a drudge or a difficult task, that that's when it became perfected. We also talked about how we tend as people to only really value things that are kind of hard to do. So we're bringing that understanding here to the looking at the paramis. I want to spend a minute about this idea of perfecting. We've talked about four different books that we've been using on Sunday morning, and Now they're all listed on the web page under the Sunday Morning Sit and the resources. And thank you to Lauren for getting that going and to Cheryl for making it possible on the web page. So Norman's book is called The World Could Be Otherwise. And he says, we are regular people doing regular things, but we are also heroic bodhisattvas. He says, everyone is a bodhisattva. Everyone has imagination and an infinite wish for the happiness and welfare of others, however much they may be out of touch with that aspiration. And being a bodhisattva, he says, is just being human. But as intentional bodhisattvas, we're trying to remember this side of our humanity more often and live it as best we can. So the bodhisattva's perfection of ethical conduct, he goes on to say, I'm going to share quite a bit of Norman in this first part. He says it's ethical conduct beyond ethical conduct. It's the entry gate to the path, and it's also the ultimate fruition. At first, it involves some intentional restraint, but as bodhisattvas continue on the path, they easily and spontaneously practice it without particularly noticing. At this point, the perfection of ethical conduct isn't uptight or restrictive. It's a joyful path of doing what comes naturally out of the fullness of the heart. He ends with these beautiful words. The perfection of ethical conduct, like an eagle in flight, soars far beyond conventional ethics into the empty blue skies of love and delight. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. The joy, peace, and delight that's available to all of us through the practice of Sila. And I want to invite us all to consider practicing with this parami as a practice of heart and joy. It's a practice of turning away from our usual self-centeredness and turning towards love and the benefit of others. So when I was coming up with this, I don't know about, I think all of us LDLs spend weeks before we give a talk, and we kind of make this Word document and throw all of our thoughts in it. And it was just last week when I realized that all of my words and phrases and thoughts that I've been throwing in there were leading me to this place of looking at the Parami of Sila as a practice of joy and heart. So it might sound a little bit too optimistic or even Pollyannish, and I've confessed to that tendency in front of you all many Sundays before, but I don't think that's what's going on here. Anyway, if you think so, feel free to share that later on when in our discussion. But I'm going to share more of my thoughts about Sila as a practice of heart and joy. Remember the Buddha's instructions to his son Rahula, where he says to consider his actions of thought, speech, and body before the action, during the action, and afterwards. And basically, that's what we're going to be doing around the Parami of Sila. Before, we have to know clearly what our values are. We've spent time on them. We've really reflected on those values. We know that they're coming from a place of connection and not a place of just, it's all about me. We're really clear about our intentions and aspirations. And during, we know that we are acting from a commitment to do no harm, that we are acting with an intention for our own peace and well-being and the peace and well-being of others. And afterwards, we feel the joy that comes from living an aligned life. Last month, when we were discussing generosity, it was such a rich month. We talked a lot about the role of self or ego. And just as with generosity, not being overly self-absorbed is an essential aspect of practicing with Sila. Last week, I had the privilege, along with several hundred others, of listening to Joy Harjo. Joy Harjo was the U.S. Poet Laureate for a few years. She's an Indigenous poet. I think she's a Muskogee from Oklahoma. A musician, a dancer, a thinker, an elder, a teacher. And she has a poem that is called I Am a Prayer. When I first heard it, I thought, yeah, that is what we're doing when we practice the perfection of Sila. We become a prayer in the world. And I don't usually use the word prayer very much. I don't know where it lands for other people. But I realized that when I recite metta or compassion phrases for myself or others, I'm actually offering prayers for them. Or when I meet a troubled person on the street or read another example of the pain and suffering, I put my hand on my heart and I say some phrase offering freedom from pain and suffering, I'm offering a prayer. And instead of just thinking that we are offering words to another, what if we actually imagine that we are the embodiment of those words and in those words of kindness and care, that we are the prayers for happiness and well-being in the world? Our dear, precious, troubled world really needs us to be prayers, needs us to be this embodiment of care and compassion. So, you know, the paramis of Sila is usually taught with the precepts. And I was interested to learn about the phrase that the Buddha used as a guideline when he was developing the five precepts. The phrase in Pali is Atanam Upamam Hatha. And it refers to the rule of using oneself as a standard for deciding how to treat others. In an article about the precepts, Bhikkhu Bodhi describes how the Buddha developed the five precepts from this abstract principle of using oneself as a standard. When he considered oneself as similar to others and others similar to oneself. In other words, others love life just as we do, so we don't kill them. Others value their own things, so we don't steal from them. Others want to be respected and valued, so we don't misuse our own energies or lie to them or gossip about them. It is said that the fifth precept was added later because heedfulness is so necessary for the first four. Ajahn Suchita says basically he just translates that fundamental principle, saying, I don't do to you what I wouldn't want you to do to me. It's all for my welfare, for the welfare of others, and leads to peace. So we can expand this some to include our common humanity, that others are just like me. Norman says that the human mind is a swirl of activity, mostly centered around the self, which we've all agreed to. Everyone, though, is more tentative, more vulnerable, and rougher than they appear. And when we accept that others are just like me, it's easier to be kinder to others and ourselves. It's kind of grounding this understanding and our understanding of human nature. And there's also a way to even broaden that abstract concept of using oneself as a standard to see how we are all connected to everyone everywhere. I recently came across this quote from Alice Walker, the wonderful author. She said, because whatever has happened to humanity, whatever is currently happening to humanity, it's happening to all of us. No matter how hidden the cruelty, no matter how far off the screams of pain and terror, we live in one world. We are one people. Thich Nhat Hanh uses the phrase intervene to describe the same universal sense of connection. So understanding how totally connected we are to one another informs this development and strengthening of our own personal values, our own personal sense of morality. And it can help us really stay clear about what our values are. In preparing this talk, I also learned a lot about, there's so many suttas that talk about the benefits that come to practitioners who follow the precepts, whose lives are really aligned with the overarching value of do no harm. One of the benefits is that we are seen by others as trustworthy, that people want to be our friends. Being trustworthy is a doorway to kalyanamitta, to spiritual friendship. We talk so much in Sunday morning about the value of sangha. This being trustworthy and being a good friend is a doorway to into that sangha. It strengthens the sangha. From one of the suttas, this is the one about the Buddha's last days. They actually list specific blessings that accrue to a righteous person through their practice of virtue. They include a favorable reputation, which I just mentioned, confident deportment without timidity in every aspect of society. That's an interesting one. A serene death and a rebirth into a happy state. Another teacher, Joseph Goldstein, talks about when the practice of non-harming is really well established, and there's not the suffering of regret. There's not that negative force in our lives that agitates our minds, that power of regret. So non-harming, he says, leads to tranquility of mind. Ultimately and simply, to live a virtual life, a virtuous life, is to live a life of non-harming. Those of us who've been practicing a lot of years, we have had so many sits where the mind is anything but tranquil. So really building on our sense of alignment with our sense of values and how we behave in the world, that will lead it to tranquility of mind sounds pretty good. So there are a lot of statements about the benefits that come to one. Tranquility, friendship, freedom from danger and animosity. But we can also just experience this joy of having a strong sense of virtue and morality by reflecting on what it feels to live a life that is aligned with our values. We can really take delight in doing good and living a life of blamelessness and ease. And we know we always bring back Philip Moffat's phrase, to the best of my ability. We're not perfect, but we can really feel the joy of living an aligned life. I had the joy the other day of having tea with a friend, and I shared with him what I was thinking of offering this morning, and he said to me that he experiences great joy when his inner life and his values are fully aligned with his outer life, how he shows up in the world. Just the alignment itself is joyful. And I think when we make non-harming a way of life, it creates such a place of ease and relaxation. Again, to the best of my ability, my actions of body and speech reflect my highest values. And Ajahn Suchita says that as we live with this clear sense of our values, the values themselves become a kind of temple, a sanctuary within which we can stand, look around, and formulate a path for practice. That alignment becomes a sanctuary where we can have clarity for what we do, what we need to do next. Someone put in the chat the word clarity, so that having a really strong sense of our own values of ethical conduct really can give you that sense of sanctuary and clarity for making decisions. As we've talked about, the paramis are practiced in daily life. They're not an extra thing we do. We don't need to add 90 minutes a day to our to-do list. They're just how we do our daily chores, how we behave at work, how we clean our house, raise our kids, relate to loved ones, how we speak to ourselves. By bringing in the clarity that comes from being aligned with our values, we're able, like Ajahn Suchita says, to steer our lives out of the confusion, the stressful, the challenging. It's daily, it's regular, it's normal. It's the parami becoming perfected. Another way of dealing with this is to celebrate our mistakes. I love how both Norman Fisher and Sylvia Vorstein talk about it. Norman says nothing helps the journey more than mistakes. And Sylvia says that she talks about both making mistakes and mending mistakes, that it's an essential part of the practice. We realize how bad we feel when we've hurt someone. And this dedication inspires us to pay better attention to the moment and to our intentions. And actually, then, when we're paying better attention to the parami of sila, it actually helps us pay better attention at all the time. She says, I pay better attention so I won't be worse. The parami of sila is, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, is usually taught by reciting and taking on the five precepts. I was going to share them, but I can't do that on my smaller computer. So I think everybody knows them, but it'll be obvious with what I'm going to be talking about. Alongside, the precepts are taught as restraints. They're trainings in restraining from. But alongside each of the precepts of restraint is a cultivation virtue. Norman describes this as restraint, development of virtue, and the joy of benefiting others. So we could look at these five. The precept to abstain from destruction of life is connected to the virtue of compassion. And some teachers say that it may result in longevity. The precept to refrain from stealing is connected to the virtue of honesty and contentment and may result in prosperity. The precept to refrain from sexual misconduct is connected to the virtue of fidelity and may result in popularity. The precept to abstain from lying is connected to the virtue of truthfulness and may result in a good reputation. And the precept to refrain from intoxicants is connected to heedfulness and may very well result in strengthening our mindfulness. Gail Stark's book that we've talked about, she has some really good practices for how to work with the precepts. I'd like to share a few that you'll really read them, maybe even print them out and have them in your home. Look at how you might refine the definition or what some of the subtleties are. What kind of attitude of mind arises when you were refraining or when you were cultivating? What attitude of mind comes up when you slip up? And after either a skillful act or an unskillful act, what kind of reflections or emotions linger? You might want to look at, you know, there are certain precepts that are more challenging for you. What are the conditions in your life that tend to lead you to breaking one or more of the precepts? Really understand them, not to judge and berate yourself. We're all a product of conditioning. You know, it's more so that we can become aware of them and understand them. I love this suggestion at the end of every day. Ask yourself, have I done anything that has caused harm? Have I done anything that was helpful? And sometimes they're just the smallest thing where you said something without the intention of doing any harm, but it was received in a different way. It was received as criticism or harmful. Also asking ourselves, was there a time when I almost harmed somebody, but then I stopped myself. Many of us have a regular metta practice. Can you actually see yourself as the embodiment of friendliness and kindness? Can you see yourself as being the prayer, as being a heroic bodhisattva? I love how there's so many wise people in our Sangha, and they've reminded us over and over again about how easy it is to start berating ourselves. And with a strong mindfulness practice, when we're so tuned in to everything that arises, when we're practicing here with Sila, what can come up is a whole litany of things that we've done wrong. And it's humbling. But as Sylvia Boorstein says in her book, humbling is not humiliating. Humbling does not have to lead to shame. It's remembering that we often don't know as much as we need to know in order to choose wisely. Another teacher, Gil Fronsdale, reminds us that the precepts are not about a bunch of shoulds, but rather they're based on the observation that some actions lead to suffering and some actions lead to happiness and freedom. So what we're doing in terms of aligning ourselves is really asking ourselves that question over and over again. Is what I'm about to do, or what I am doing, or what I've just done, did it lead to increased suffering or increased happiness for myself and others? And is it a springboard for investigation and for peace? We want to be careful that we haven't set goals that are for our ethical conduct that are so high that they're just kind of set up for self-judgment. There's such a desire in our world, especially in the kind of Seattle liberal wanting to do the right thing kind of environment. Norman reminds us that, I love this phrase that he says, no one who lives in a violent and unjust world can claim ethical purity or even semi-purity. We just have to be confident that we're doing the best we can. So we look at the goals we've set. Are they too high? Are they a setup for disappointment and self-judgment? Or perhaps our goals aren't lofty enough. Let's just look at those and have them be an important part of our practice. I think it's also important to reflect on whether what you've claimed as your own ethical conduct values are your own. As part of this, preparing for this talk, I kind of look back on my life, and I've been married twice, both to very wonderful men. They both had very strong opinions, well, basically about everything, but also about just the best way to live. And then, you know, I wouldn't have been with them if I hadn't agreed that with their values. But I realized that for much of those years, I really let them take the lead in this arena and took their values as my own. I don't know if it's a woman thing. I don't know if it's something we do or if it's just everybody does that. But in the 6 years since Bill died, I've really examined a lot of that and made some changes. And now my list of values really feel like my own. And I know that living in this very challenging world, it can be hard to feel like we are living ethically and aligned. We are all in relationship with the entire universe, and so everything we do matters. In the process of developing this talk, I found and then I shared with you so many beautiful images and phrases from our many teachers. I like the idea of kind of writing them down on some post-its and sticking them around my house. That might be something you'd like to do as well. Especially the idea that our ethical conduct values become a temple, become a sanctuary, or perhaps that we see ourselves as heroic bodhisattvas or see yourself as the prayer, or maybe just the phrase, the bliss of blamelessness. I'm really optimistic that all of us, because of our sincerity of practice, we can find and stick to our moral compass, avoiding harm, doing good, and benefiting others. And we can do that even in the stickiest, most challenging situations. So I want to end with where I started, with inviting everybody to really practice with this as a practice of heart and joy, of ease, relaxation, and delight. When we do no harm to the best of our ability in every moment, do no harm to ourselves or others, it has such a sense of ease and joy. We do no harm, so there's no worry. Do the best we can. No worry. Know what is happening in our minds and honor the mental state. Honor the hindrances when they arise. Honor and act with the underlying commitment of doing no harm. There's a pretty sweet thing in Sylvia's book. She calls it a contemporary gratitude prayer. She says, I am thankful that thus far today I've not had any unkind thoughts or said any harsh words or done anything that I regret. However, now I need to get out of bed and so things may become more difficult. And she says, I think I'll start by reciting the precepts. Do no harm to anyone. Take nothing that is not freely offered. Speak truthfully and helpfully. Use my sexual energy wisely and keep my mind clear. Thank you for your kind attention. I know I shared a lot, and so we now have a time to do more sharing with each other. When we did the focus groups, people talked about how important those times are to be able to share our own thoughts and feelings with each other. So I am going to make some breakout groups. Oh, and of course, invite people if you have to leave. Thank you for joining us. Have fun with this Parami this month. Really feel the joy that comes from living a life that's aligned. And you know, forgive yourself when you slip up. And this is the first morning of Sila. So, bringing, you know, what's your general attitude towards it? How have you been working with it in the past? What challenges, if any, come up for you? This is a time with a Dharma buddy. Feel safe and secure and sharing. Know that we give each other time to talk and listen. We don't give advice. We keep in confidence what the other has shared. Okay, and then I'll call you back. You'll get about 14 minutes. Enjoy. So welcome back. I think everybody is coming back. And I know some of you were in twos and some were in threes. I hope I gave you all enough time to talk and share with each other. It's such a wonderful gift to be invited to share the Dharma. And I find that for the weeks that I'm looking at the topic, it just becomes so rich. So I hope that that same thing happens for you for all month. Feel free to unmute yourself. If you would like to share anything that has come up for you, how are you feeling about diving into Sila? How's that? Yes, Jerry, please. And then Julie after.
Yeah, just quick. I really appreciate our conversation in the small group. We were talking about the ethical dilemmas that all this stuff brings up. It's not clear-cut stuff. And we probably could have gone through every one of the precepts in that regard.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what's so wonderful about having our practice. because we've been developing these skills of looking at things and saying, is this true? Is it not? What are the emotions that are affecting this? What are the conditions? What's going on? And then we make the best kind of choice we can. Yeah. Thank you. It's not an easy path. It's not a path without potholes, huh? Yeah. Thanks, Jerry. Yes, Julie, please.
I want to second what Jerry's, both things that Jerry said. First of all, that the whole idea we talked about, you know, you can just sort of peel this stuff back and just keep looking deeper and deeper. And also the fact that, it was really nice to be in a teeny tiny group too. It's just it's a very different experience and it's quite lovely. But, another thing that came up that I just wanted to mention, is this whole idea of bravery and courage and the fact that, you know, the willingness and the ability that we all have to look at these things and look really deeply at these things is, I don't know. I just think it's nice to remind ourselves it's not hard and we're doing it and we're not perfect, but it should feel really good in that respect. So that's what I wanted to share. Thank you.
It's like echoing what Norman said, that we're all bodhisattvas. We're all heroic bodhisattvas. And sometimes just getting out of bed in the morning can be a heroic act, you know, because you wake up and you ask yourself, what's the mind state that I'm waking up with? And sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's, you know, emotional or sad or scary or whatever. And then we do it anyway. You know, we take that step. So, Charlotte and then Nana.
My effort is to restrain from complaint, about things that I don't like or I think I don't like. Things like perfumed soap in the bathroom. I don't need to say, why can't they do unperfumed soap? Yeah, blah, blah. And, or, you know, somebody behind me is coughing. And I, you know, they can't control it, and neither can I. And so I've been successful, and then I haven't. So it's still a work in progress. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Charlotte. Whew. Can't we all identify with that one? What, you know, it's not to my liking. So it shouldn't be happening. You know, exactly. Oh boy, being human. Nana, please go ahead.
Thank you, Susan, and thanks for really nudging, to speak for me, in the right direction. So wet morality, you know, triggers a sort of abstract do-gooder thing that people with significant spiritual understanding have. But in my reflections, I know immorality brings disease, morality brings ease, yet my conditioned self is very addicted to immorality because I've practiced being immoral for a very, 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 very long time. Cool. And in the same way, if I've gotten tired of immorality and I want to inculcate morality, then with practice, I'll get good at it. And you said a few moments ago, potholes along the way in reference to Jerry's point. And I actually want to borrow something from what Charlotte just shared. And I'll apply it to morality. The perfume of morality even negates the stench of immorality. Thank you.
I'm so honored by all the wisdom that shows up every Sunday. Wow. Lauren, please.
Yeah, we picked up on your talking about alignment with values, and how our value is not to harm. But sometimes Jerry spoke of these ethical dilemmas. And sometimes there's this very, it's hard to know. Sometimes we have to draw a boundary or a limit. And we're worried that it might harm someone, but then it's supposed to be for the welfare of ourselves and the welfare of others. And sometimes, you know, both can't happen necessarily, which made me think of the equanimity phrases that we use, and specifically the one, so I'm going to read it because I found it here. I care for you, but I cannot control your happiness or unhappiness. May I be at peace with your journey. I just wanted to bring that up because I think we're going to come, at least for me, there are these times where it's not clear cut what the ethical, the moral, the right thing to do is, and we really have to reflect on it. And sometimes we may have to feel, you know, a hurt that we might be causing another person, but it feels like it's the right thing to do. So, and how we do it, I guess, is what's really important. And so, you know, like, I know there's more phrases like that, and it comes in equanimity, but yeah. I just wanted to bring that up.
Thank you. Would you read that phrase again? That equanimity?
Yeah, and there's another one that's a little better, but I can't find it. So this, but it has the same idea. I care for you, but I cannot control your happiness or unhappiness. May I be at peace with your journey. I think of that with my daughter, for example. I think we all, if you have someone you really are close to and love, and especially kids, you know, it's come up with me a lot that I've had to use that. But anyway, yeah, that's the phrase.
Yeah, right on. Thank you so much for sharing that. Maria.
Oh, I just want to say thank you so much, Lauren, to say that, because that really resonated with me. And I also realized that with either our children or the loved ones, that I do agree, like, we can't control other people's feelings or behaviors, but we can control our own feelings and behaviors. And we don't have to agree with them, but when we really love someone, we do have to accept that. So thank you so much for bringing that up, Lauren.
Thank you, Maria. Well, exactly, you know, honoring each other's journeys and the way they manifest, which will be individual. And one of the things about spiritual friendship, having Dharma friends, it's a pretty special thing where we can have these kinds of conversations. And I so highly value it. Wow. So this is going to be a fun month, huh? And, you know, I didn't talk at all about the ethical dilemmas. So thank you to the small group and to Jerry for bringing it up. Because it isn't just a straight path that, oh, this is clear. But I love that the way that Ajahn Suchito talks about when we're clear about our own set of values, it really creates this space, this sanctuary from which we can make the right decisions. And our practice just keeps on feeding into that, the wisdom that's there. So acknowledging the beauty of our practice, the sincerity of our commitment to this practice of moving towards the end of suffering for us and for others, and we extend that wish for the happiness and well-being of all beings everywhere. Thank you so much for being here today.